Welcome back to Pandanomics, a series exploring the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and what the coming months may hold for Canadians. My name is Stephen Maurice. I'm the editor of Scotiabank Perspectives. My guest today is the person whose job is to make sure that Scotiabank's customers, employees, regulators, and maybe even the CEO can sleep at night secure in the knowledge that the bank and people's money are safe. Daniel Moore is Group Head and Chief Risk Officer at Scotiabank. Daniel, welcome to Pandanomics and Happy New Year, if it's not too late to be saying that.
No, thank you, Stephen. It still feels very much like the new year. And I hope it is indeed a new year for all of us in so many ways.
Yeah, no kidding. It's not starting out that way, but it can only get better.
You got it.
I was going to save this question till the end, but at the risk, so to speak, of running out of time before I get to it, I'm actually going to go ahead and ask it now. You've been with the bank for more than 20 years, but your academic background is actually in science, and not just any science. You have a PhD in theoretical physics from Oxford. How did you end up at a bank instead of, say, NASA or something? What's the through line from high-level physics to high-level banking?
Oh, great question, Stephen. I did physics because I loved the process. I loved doing math, and I loved solving what I thought were hard problems. When I got to the end of doing physics, Stephen, I realized that I didn't want to be a career academic, so I knew what I didn't want to do. I didn't know what I did want to do. And so, like most people that don't know what they want to do, I became a consultant. And so I spent a couple of years working for a consulting firm that you might have heard of called Anderson Consulting. They no longer exist courtesy of a company called Enron that brought down their parent company, Arthur Anderson. But for a number of years, I worked as a technology consultant with that firm until I realized I like doing technology, but I like doing math stuff better. So I came into this finance thing thinking that, you know, I could solve Black-Scholes equation and do a few other things, and maybe that was useful. And indeed it was. So I started out in derivative pricing, in risk, indeed, and for building some of our pricing models in risk. Ended up trading equity derivatives in the heart of the Russian currency crisis and the Asian currency crisis and the Russian default. Two things we never thought would happen happened. A sovereign defaulted and Asian currencies depegged. The VIX went incredibly from about 10 to about 24, which was amazing. For context, this VIX measure went up over 80 in the latest crisis. So things that are unprecedented keep on happening.
What's a VIX measure?
Oh, thank you. I threw a bit of terminology in there. In the trading markets, it's a measure of volatility. We look at the options market and they tell us something about the volatility of the underlying markets. And so now you can actually trade that volatility as a commodity. And so that was a very important measure that we tracked back then. And we still track it and trade it via futures markets today. Yeah. So I went from equity into equity derivatives into a number of others. Did interest rate derivatives, did credit derivatives, spent some time in Europe working for the bank, spent some time in Asia Pacific for the bank, working in GBM there, before coming back into risk back in 2015, Stephen, and then after a few years becoming CRO. So a little bit of a circuitous pattern, but I would say the wonderful thing is the bank has kept me busy and engaged the whole time because it is such a big place and we're involved in so many different businesses and activities that I don't feel like I've been able to stand still for more than a short period of time during that whole engagement. And this has been no exception.
Yeah, I'll bet you've been challenged to rethink and pivot over the course of the last year in any number of ways. But before we get into COVID and the challenges that presented to you and to the bank and to risk management, maybe just describe a little bit what a CRO does. What does a chief risk officer do? What types of risks are you assessing, and what does the risk mean to the bank? What are the dangers that the bank potentially faces and that its customers by extension also face?
Well, the CRO is a relatively new invention in banking actually, and it's making its way into other industries, but it's really very specific to banking and originated there. And historically, it really was the chief credit officer, a guy that adjudicated all of the credits at the bank and really with a focus on corporate and commercial credits. During the 90s, when we had that Russian default and Asian currency crisis, people realized that you could lose money in markets as well. And so they said, well, we need someone to watch over that. So they threw market risk into the list of things to worry about. And then when we had rates go up considerably back in the 90s, they said, we need to maybe think about rates as well. So balance sheet management became part of the thinking and FX movements as a result as well. With the passage of time, actually, it's evolved from nice to have to a have to have. So now, in fact, if you're a bank in the U.S. under the rules of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC, with over $50 billion in assets, you must have a CRO. Many asset managers, like hedge funds and institutional asset managers, now have put CROs in place because they realize their investors want someone who's got that purview over the risks the bank faces. And so that gets back to your question, what does a CRO really do? Well, I think it's poorly named, Stephen. I think the CRO is actually the CWO. The CRO is the chief worry officer. And it's your job, if it can go wrong, then you probably should be worrying about it and thinking about it and having people put it in context of the overall risks of the bank. And so what that means is that perimeter of the list of things to frankly worry about has changed remarkably through the years. So it started out, as I said, with those what were called financial risks. We thought about credit risk, we thought about market risk, we thought about interest rates and foreign exchange. And in more recent years, it's evolved into what are called the non-financial risks, what I call the core risks, because we all know that those risks become pretty darn financial pretty darn quickly. And this includes things like operational risk, cyber risk, insurance risk, even things today like climate risk and matters around HR risk as well. So it's really a very broad perspective on the bank, which is, going back to my earlier point, what makes it so engaging? Because what we've had to focus on in the last year has been remarkably different than it was in 2019, which again was even itself remarkably different than it was a year or two prior to that. It just keeps on evolving as banking keeps evolving, and the threat landscape keeps on evolving as well.
Right. And so, I mean, you can understand, or a person can understand, why the bank would want to protect itself from risk, and, you know, regulators would be trying to do the same. What does it mean for a customer? Like, in what way are we protecting them through our risk management systems?
Yeah, probably three ways, right? So first of all, is the old fashioned banking way of, you know, does my money go into a bank that's got a vault, whether it's a real vault or some form of a virtual digital vault, where my money is safe, right? When I go to get it back, am I going to get my money back? That's job one, and we should never lose sight of that, right? That's always job one. And that's safety of our systems, physical as well as technological, and primarily technological today. Safety of our liquidity. Have we got enough liquidity on hand to satisfy the customer's need for their money to come back to them? But then think about the operational elements of that too. Right? It's not only can I get my money back, can I get it back when I want it? Can I send it to people that I want to send it to? Or can I run queries on my financial position when I want to? So there's a level of operational resilience that's so important for a bank today, particularly as needs of change, right? When I was growing up, there was the 3-5-3 rule of banking. Have you heard about the 3-5-3 rule of banking?
No, I don't know what that is.
It was that you borrowed money at 3%, you lent it out at 5%, and you were on the golf course by 3 o'clock. But if you tried to go to your bank branch after 3 o'clock, maybe 5 o'clock on a Friday, it was closed. And there was no expectation of it being anything other than closed. That's changed now. We are 24/7 enterprises with very fast recovery and very high observability on any delays or downtime that we have. Particularly with social media today. So the expectations are very high, and that's appropriate in today's environment. Then lastly, I'd say the third thing that our customers are primarily entrusting us with is their data. And I think the customer's expectation around privacy around the value of their financial data is higher than any other form of data, maybe except for health data, right? If we look at the value that we ascribe to social data, to who I have as friends or what queries I ask of Google, that's very low. We can debate whether that's appropriate or not, but very clearly your financial data is sacrosanct. And so banks have an obligation by virtue of the license they have to operate in society to value that data, to treat it with the appropriate degree of trust. And so we spend a ton of time thinking about the right way to both protect data as well as to use it responsibly.
Okay. More questions just about how you assess risk and how you anticipate it. But given our time, I think maybe we'll just segue now into the past year. So, you know, we might have been starting to get some signals of something going on maybe as early as January of 2020 and then into February, of course, sort of the full, you know, lockdown and more strict measures didn't happen until sort of mid-March, but there were some signals before that. When did your antenna start going up? And then how did you, I mean, the month of February and March must have been kind of crazy for you as you tried to figure out how the bank as an important financial institution was going to deal with this unexpected crisis.
It's amazing to look back on these things, Stephen. And it's a constant reminder that we're really bad at anything other than straight line prediction as human beings. We don't deal with exponential curves very well. You know, if I was recollecting over Christmas break with my eldest daughter what we were doing this time last year, and she and I were skiing this time last year on a local hill, and she said, "Hey, Dad, did you hear about this, you know, crazy flu thing they've got over in this province, Wahoo or something in China?" And Wuhan, you mean? Yes, that's the one. Let's go do our next run. Honestly, people will tell you that I think they saw, you know, there will always be some people that said they predicted it. I don't think any rational person did. And only with the benefit of hindsight can you look back and connect the dots and see how, you know, we could have and should have anticipated some of these things. And so that's a lesson learned, right? We need to be ready for the unpredictable. And which isn't to say we need to predict the unpredictable. Having contingency plans is different than being ready for particular outcomes. And I think that's a large part of the practice of risk management, is having plans in place, having excess capital, having defenses in place, but to realize that when things go poorly, the first thing to go is the plan. Now, if I look back at how this particular crisis evolved, it follows a pattern per most crises and how they've evolved in the past. They all start with a market reaction. The fastest moving thing that we have is the capital markets. And very quickly, S&P sold off. This VIX thing we talked about spiked up. Debt markets responded. And so our trading books all had to respond appropriately as well. So all eyes went on the trading books and how are we positioned there? And can we get ourselves into a more defensive position? And the next thing in very short order after capital markets is the impact on liquidity. I talked about the importance of banks safeguarding customers' deposits. Well, that's all about our own liquidity. And so we really quickly worked with our friends in Treasury and Finance, as well as regulators, to have a coordinated response on the liquidity in the system and the liquidity in the bank. And I think all teams, external and internal, central banks, regulators, and internal treasury teams get great kudos for taking the learnings from primarily 08 and applying them twofold at thrice the velocity. Because the liquidity very quickly went from being a challenge we had to face to being something where we didn't have to think about it at all. In fact, the problem was we had too much liquidity, which was a great outcome to have to worry about. Then you move into the slower moving impacts. Really, credit is slower moving. You know, if you're a commercial account, you need to worry about liquidity. You need to burn through your existing liquidity before you have a problem. And it's very predictable. You know how these things will play out. And if you're in a larger player, you have to worry about the impact on capital markets. Can you raise enough debt or raise enough equity to support your business? And we are still dealing with the credit impacts. I believe we've largely dealt with the credit impacts, but they're still with us, and we will work through the implications as they go forward here. Because while an end is in sight, it's only in sight. It's not present. We're just in the second half of this play here. And then lastly, it's the build back process, right? So what has permanently changed? What's structurally different? And then how can we get back to normal business operations, but more important, normal profitability and normal service to our customers in this environment? We've largely achieved the last one, the service to our customers, I think. But pivoting the business model, to use that new phrase, to the new normal, I think all banks are going through that process, because digital adoption has gone through the roof for all businesses, from buying your athleisure to buying your groceries to doing your banking. But also consumption patterns may well change with some permanence as well.
And so the anticipation, again, from your perspective, was ensuring the liquidity of the bank, which is important, not just the bank, but to obviously to customers as well. Was that your main challenge over the course of this? And how are you still analyzing what's going on in terms of the impact that, you know, spikes in cases, whether or not the vaccine will be distributed effectively over the course of the next few months? Are you kind of constantly reassessing, given what the external situation is, how the bank reacts to that and how it protects its customers?
We are, Stephen. Yeah, the liquidity front was very intense for a very short period of time. Call it, depending on when you call the end of that, 6 to 12 weeks of very intense work. Again, really led by the Treasury folks, and we were there to support and advise, to ensure that quantitative easing measures were rolled out, that we were accessing capital markets through unsecured and secured issuance, we're attracting deposits. So that all was done very, very intensely, but very quickly. And as I said, actually became a situation where we had too much liquidity as an industry and as a bank very quickly. Great outcome, great problem to have to worry about. Now, in this longer tail credit stuff, we have a crazy, crazy job ahead of us. The in our accounting world, we have this thing called IFRS 9. It's an accounting standard. And what it asks us to do is to have foresight on what our credit losses are going to be over the remaining lifetime of all our lending assets. In normal times, that sounds like a Herculean task. In times of a pandemic, when data is coming out daily and the situation is changing daily, in a situation of a pandemic when the central banks even refuse to provide forecasts on GDP growth, which drives credit outcomes for us, and we're asked to have this level of, call it, perfect foresight on outcomes in the future, it's a real challenge. So we've responded. We've done our very best work in terms of trying to make those estimations. But we are still estimating that because, as I said, this has a long tail. The credit losses will continue for several years into the future. And so we have to continuously relook at our models. It's something we're doing on a monthly basis. We use great human judgment to try and overlay those models, to try and accommodate some of the shortcomings of what are, by necessity, historical models in unprecedented times. But it is one of the industry challenges we have. But I'm really proud of the team's ability to respond to that and to produce really great estimates. As we look at how we're performing right now, it's very close to those estimates, which speaks to the quality of the people and the technology.
Which is a great segue. I was going to ask you about the technology. And then you talked about, obviously, the huge spike in digitization of banking and commerce of all kinds, but also behind the scenes, there have been huge investments in technology, including things like machine learning and AI. What role do they play in your work in risk assessment and making those determinations and forecasts?
Yeah, thanks.
Or in other ways, whether helping customers or whatever applications there might be for those technologies.
Yeah, I don't think there's been an area of the bank where we've applied you know, analysis and thinking around data, whether it be AI or even more traditional techniques around data, and not had a material yield. I mean, I can think of a couple, but only really a couple of instances where it didn't work out as planned. Because the data allows us to really understand our customer better. And when you can understand the customer better, you can get better segmentation and better individualized treatments. And that treatment can be origination. Do I offer you the right product for what you need today? It can be modification of the products that you have. Do you need more credit card limit? Do you need less credit card limit? Or it can be how I deal with you at the, you know, at the back end of a credit life cycle, where maybe you need restructuring of your credit. Maybe you need to work your way through a collections process. And how we help you through that process, what tools we use, very much matters, very much as a function of who you are and what your personal situation is. And that's code for data. So, you know, we've rolled out data. We focused first on retail, but we've rolled it out materially throughout corporate and commercial as well. Retail makes sense because you've got the large law of large numbers there. You've got over 20 million customers that you can apply analysis to. But one of the things I'm very excited about right now that we've rolled out is this tool we've called Sophia, not accidentally named after the goddess of knowledge, which we use to predict future liquidity of our commercial accounts. I mean, the one thing that gets commercial customers that don't have access to capital markets for funding is their liquidity. So the better we can predict that, the better we can help the ones get into trouble, avoid getting into trouble, and the better we can identify the ones that have high quality cash flows, very predictable cash flows, and offer them products that can accelerate their growth. So that's just one example of where we've applied data and analytics to understand the customer better, and then to get down to a segment of one individualized treatment.
That's amazing. And I'm sure lots more to come on the technology front. Just maybe a final question, because we could go on for an hour like this, but we try and keep it fairly tight. Can you give me just sort of your look ahead to 2021? What does it look like in your world? As we said, things not going fantastic right now, but I think it's still somewhat of a positive outlook for later on in the year. What's it looking like for you?
Well, it's like watching sort of one of these popular movies. So, you know, in the second half of the movie, the intensity of the action heats up, but you're pretty certain that, you know, the good guy's going to win. And I think we feel the same way here, right? The action sequences are going to heat up. And, you know, here in Ontario, we just had new lockdown measures introduced. My wife and I had a little bit of cry in our soup last night because our kids are going to be home with us for longer and out of school. And I think it's going to be, you know, I said this before, a challenge particularly through the winter to deal with the impacts of the medical outcomes, the health consequences, the financial consequences even. But, you know, our government in Canada has shown great capacity to support people that are affected. And I think that's been very helpful. That shows signs of continuing. But importantly, on the medical front, the vaccine is starting to flow now. My sister-in-law got the vaccine last week. My brother, who's a frontline worker, will be getting it shortly as well. They're both frontline workers. And so we know the end game is in play. And so that's a cause for optimism. We know things will get better. And so I think that gives a sense that we can really gut this out in the short term. Because the back half of 2021, in some way, shape, or form, whether it's June or September, it doesn't really matter. We're in the end game here. We can see the beginning of the end. So I'm optimistic. You know, we're going to have to pull together as a bank, pull together as a country and a community to get through this. It's not going to be easy. It is, I think, the test of the generation, and will have long-term impacts on people's behavior, on the shape of economies. But, you know, with every crisis, there comes a silver lining and there comes change that is for the good. And you can go back through history and look at that. I personally have just had the chance to spend so much more time with my kids because they're at home and doing simple things like taking the dog for a walk because there ain't nothing else to do, Stephen. And that's something I'm thankful for and something that I hope continues.
Yes, well, on that very optimistic note, and I absolutely share that, the extra time with the family has been for the most part, a positive thing. But we will end on that optimistic note. Daniel, I really want to thank you for joining us today. I mean it when I say we could have gone on for another half an hour easily, but I really appreciate it. That was fascinating, and thanks for taking the time to talk today.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been my genuine pleasure.
I've been speaking with Daniel Moore, Group Head and Chief Risk Officer at Scotiabank. Thanks for listening to Pandanomics. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe on Apple, Google, or Spotify. See you soon.